Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
How you doing, everybody? This is the Solartopia Green Power and Wealth Show. I'm Harvey Wasserman. Back for another great hour. We got some background noise here. We'll get it sorted out in New York, I'm sure. Don't know what's going on, but you never know. It's always fun to be on the radio. So we got some great guests for you today. We got a great show. We're going to talk first about Fukushima and the upcoming demonstrations on March 11th, which will be the third anniversary of this horrible, horrible disaster, which keeps getting worse and worse. We have Nick Tabbitt with us to talk for about 15 minutes about the growing list of demonstrations that's going to go on around the world on Fukushima Day, on nuclear power. General, I will be fasting that day. Some background noise going on here, and hopefully it'll be gone in a minute. And then we're going to talk, so we'll start with Nick Tabbitt, and then we're going to talk with Bill Zimmerman at around 15, about a quarter after the hour. We're going to talk with Bill about his times in the 60s, his book, Troublemaker. And then we're going to talk about student loan debt. So that's going to be our show. Nick, are you there?
I'm here, yes. How are
Nick Tabbitt, do you have some background noise going on there?
I was in a cafe getting a cup of coffee.
That's what it was. All right, I couldn't figure out what was going on.
But now I'm going outside, and now it'll be maybe some different background noise, but hopefully a lot less of it. How are you today, Harvey?
I'm good. How are you? So let's see if we can minimize the background noise. That sounds a lot better. What kind of cafe are you in?
Starbucks. Don't tell anybody, though.
Well, okay, we won't.
I know everybody's down on Starbucks.
What town are you in?
I'm in Berkeley.
Berkeley, California.
Yes.
The red capital of the world. All right. Glad to have you with us. Now, Nick,
yes. You
are helping to organize demonstrations around the country, actually around the world, on March 11th, Fukushima Day, the third anniversary
right. Of
the disaster at Fukushima. Tell us about this. What's going on?
Well, basically, the people here in Berkeley and San Francisco, there's a group called No Nukes Action Committee, and that's actually grown out of something called No Nukes Action Asia, which are people in Japan and other Pacific Rim nations. But here in the Bay Area, they've been going for a year and a half to the Japan consulate on Fremont Street every month on the 11th to mark that day, and they've been writing a letter to the prime minister, whoever it is at the time, and delivering it to the general consul at the consulate. And the letter tells how they feel about the nuclear accident and what's gone on since, and presents some demands about what they want the prime minister to do. And the consul comes down and meets them and receives it. And the guy who was there for a long time, I think his name is Mr. Iwate, was very nice and receptive, and he even cried one time. They met him upstairs in the consulate and talked to him for a long time. He was very sympathetic, but he's recently been replaced with another consul, and he was actually sent to the Marshall Islands, believe it or not. It's kind of ironic because that's the site of the nuclear tests.
Well, maybe that's why they sent him there.
That's what I was thinking.
So the current prime minister, of course, is Shinzo Abe. Very right-wing, no mistake,
right.
No accident that he supports both nuclear power and nuclear weapons and is militarizing Japan and has put into effect a terrible state censorship law, which is a state secrets act, they call it, which is cracking down on information coming out of Fukushima. So tell us, where are these demonstrations organized so far?
All right. Well, one of our initial goals was to organize demonstrations in every single U.S. Japan consulate. So we have about maybe 9 of them lined up so far, 9 or 10, and another 7 cities to go. My computer is not on right this second in front of me, but from memory I can tell you we're still working on we're working on Detroit, Atlanta, Chicago, Hawaii. We've got a bunch already: L.A., New York, San Francisco. What else? If you want, I will try to set it up and give you more complete
picture.
Well, no,
it's all right.
But yeah, we have, like I say, we have about 7 to go, but also people in other countries. I know in Berlin, they're going to go to the consulate and deliver a letter, and hopefully some more. I haven't heard from everybody. I'm trying to get the word out there and get people to tell me what they're doing.
Well, what does the letter say? What are you saying to the Japanese consulate? Is it one letter for all the demonstrations, or is everybody writing their own letter? What's the deal?
Everyone is writing their own letter. We want you to write what you feel and tell them what you want. You know, we offer some examples if you want, you know, of previous letters. Might give you some ideas. But we want everyone to do their own thing. The only thing is that we have a protocol for the letter. According to Japanese law, if you follow this protocol, they are required to accept the letter, come down and accept it and send it on to the Prime Minister. And the protocol is fairly simple. You just have to address it to the Prime Minister and also to the General Consul at that consulate. You have to have one person, you know, like sign the letter, at least put their name at the end and put their address, or at least like an email address. And deliver it, you know, hand deliver it to the consul or deputy consul. And if you do those things, they have to accept it and they have to send it on to the PM.
That's the Prime Minister.
Now that you mentioned it, I'm going to see if I can embed. There's a document we have about the protocol, and I'm going to see if I can just embed that into that website. I don't know if I want to post the entire thing, the whole text, but if I have to, I'll do that. So anybody
All right, Nick,
can read.
What is the website that people can look at to get
the
protocol and to also find out where these demonstrations are?
Yeah, it's what you put on your website. I believe it's Fukushima Third Anniversary Events.blogspot.com. It's basically just a one long page, you know, with all of the events worldwide listed, one after the other, with the contact people in case you have questions at each place. We've put all the Japan consulate actions in the U.S. first, and then all the other kinds of actions, of which there are many, after that. And there's a lot in Europe. They're going to close down 7 bridges along the Rhine River, for instance.
Who is?
Sort of a consortium of European groups, anti-nuclear groups. They've all agreed to do this on the same day.
Because of Fukushima, you're going to close down 7 bridges in Europe?
Yeah, they're called atomic bridges. They're bridges across which atomic materials or equipment have been transported. So they want to make a statement about that. And they're going to do it on Sunday the 9th, European time.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, the 11th, in November, when we delivered petitions to the United Nations, we called for the 11th of every month to be a fast day. And so I'm going to be fasting again on March 11th, and maybe you can incorporate that into your liturgy there to inform people that many people will be fasting on March 11th to...
I will be happy to mention that, and I know a couple of people here are going to be fasting. I think that's been a theme somehow universal, like in the brain, you know, in the airwaves or whatever, that it's a time to fast.
Okay, your website is posted also. There's a link to my website at nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org. Go on the Take Action side, people who are listening, and you can see the call from Nick and the other organization, well, your affiliated organizations. I will actually be in Los Angeles and try and go to the consulate there. There's consulates in New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles. Where else did you know you can think of offhand, Ben? Nick?
Well, what we're working on, Chicago, we're pretty sure, Seattle, Portland. What else? Then right.
Atlanta.
I know people in Flagstaff are going to collect letters to the Prime Minister, but there's no consulate there. They will just have to send them, I guess. But we're still working on others. D.C., like I say, Atlanta.
Is there a scheduled event in Washington D.C. at the Japanese consulate?
Well, we're working on it. Like I say, these are tentative. We're pretty sure it'll pull together. It's still like probably in a few days I'll know.
For all right, so
but
people who are interested,
soon as
come
I know,
to.
We're going to post it immediately.
Please come to nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org. There's a link to Nick Tabbitt's website, and you will be able to compose your own letter and participate, hopefully, in the presenting of these petitions at the Japanese consulate in your city or nearby. Is there any civil disobedience planned with this, Nick?
Well, closing the bridges is civil disobedience. Not too much else that I've heard of. They're probably going to make a lot of noise in Berlin, but I don't think they're going to shut anything down. You'll have to, like, look at it. It's a lot of stuff. I can't remember all the details of all the events. But I think it's a day more for, you know, remembrance and mourning and vigil. You know, here in Berkeley, we're going to do just a silent meditation in a public space. We're still working out which space. But we want people to think of Japan, and we want them to think about the people there and what they're suffering, and to really, you know, take a good look at that. You know, we hope that doesn't expand to the rest of the world in time if things get worse and worse. But right now, people are, they need your help there. And so we want to make people aware of that.
Well, of course, we haven't been hearing much from Fukushima or from Japan about the disaster. The State Secrets Act has definitely put a chill on the flow of information. Have you got any new information from Japan and what's happening at Fukushima?
I'd like to point people to a particular website. It's called FukushimaDiary.com. This website is run by a man who spends like 10 hours a day reading every single thing that TEPCO publishes and analyzing all the reports and translating some of it into English. And it's a real wealth of information. You can search their back posts and stuff. It's Fukushima-Diary.com, and it's very particular, you know, factual information and analyzation of what's going on right there at the site. And there's revelations every day. I mean, it's really beyond belief, a lot of what you can read there. But it's unfortunately true. So what I can tell you lately is all the measurements for the past few years have been wrong, they realize, or at least most of them, and that their equipment wouldn't measure beyond a certain point. So they were not checking up. But now they have to remeasure all sorts of samples of water and this and that. And some of it's going to be 10 times higher than previously stated. You know, the situation there is pretty terrible. I have another blog actually called Fukushima Watch, blogspot. Actually, let me point you somewhere else. The organization I'm a part of, it's Fukushima Response Bay Area. And we have a website called FukushimaResponseBayArea.org. And there's a rundown of the whole situation, which will tell you pretty much what's going on at the site. And it's very bad news. And we really want people to know about it and do something about it.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Nick, thanks so much for doing this. If you will email me those website connections, I'll put them up at nukefree.org and at PRN, where we list the program. I want to start going on what... the horrifying news from Fukushima, except that we do have now the TEPCO has admitted that at least some of their measurements were off by a factor of 500%.
500,
no surprise there. The only surprise is they admitted to it. So, Nick Tabbitt, thanks so much for being Bill Zimmerman. You're on with us here. We're going to switch over to Bill and talk about the 60s and student loans. But, Nick, I want you to come back and update us in a week, if you will, on time, same place, on updated information on the demonstrations. If you'll do that until March 11th, I'd appreciate it.
Oh, great.
In fact, our show, we will have a show. March 11th is a Tuesday, so we will have a show on Fukushima Day, and you can tell us what's going on that day, okay?
Oh, great. Yeah, I want to thank you very much for helping out with this. We just want to get as many people out on the streets as possible.
Okay, and I will be sending you some articles. If you can send them to the people on your list, that would be great, and we'll just move ahead with this. It's a horrifying, tragic, infuriating, terrifying, incredibly dangerous situation, and we'll just keep at it. So thank you so much, Nick Tabbitt. We'll talk to you next week. All right, that was Nick Tabbitt talking to us from the Starbucks in Berkeley. We're now joined also in the Bay Area, I believe. Bill Zimmerman, are you with us?
I am with you, Harvey, but I'm down in the L.A. area.
L.A., Bay Area, it's all the same. Where are you in L.A.?
up in Topanga Canyon, which is between L.A. and Malibu.
Oh, are you hippies? I know Topanga Canyon. Whenever I visit, I have a grandson in the valley, and so whenever I visit him and my daughter and son, I drive, whenever I possibly can, I drive through Topanga Canyon to Will Rogers Park.
Well,
it
you
is
go
absolutely
right by
gorgeous.
Our house then.
I haven't seen you. I expect you'd be hitchhiking on the road or something like that.
No, I'm waiting for my first grandchild, which is due on Sunday.
Oh, mazel tov, I guess, or congratulations, whatever you want to say. Fantastic. This one was actually my grandson in L.A. is my third, and I just had a fourth. I didn't. My stepdaughter did.
Well,
no,
you're
my
way
fifth.
Ahead of me.
Yes, I am. Well, anyway, but you were ahead of us in the 1960s. We're going to talk to you about two things. We're going to go about 20 minutes with you on the 60s and your book on the 60s, which was called Troublemaker. Is that right?
Yeah, Troublemaker. The subhead is a memoir from the front lines of the 60s.
Oh, my God. You were on the front lines. Of course, Abbie Hoffman, my wonderful friend Abbie Hoffman, who I miss every day of the world, every day of the week, once told me that if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. So I don't know. That's what people ask me if I teach college, and of course they know I'm of that age, and so they ask me if I was at Woodstock, and I instruct them that the proper answer if you're asked if you're at Woodstock is, I don't remember. but you obviously remembered enough to write a book about it. We're going to, if you will, in New York, if you'll play just a quick cut of the Beatles song, this to get us in the mood, that'd be great.
Okay.
Hold on here. They're queuing it up. Here we go.
Evolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright. Right. You say you got a real solution. Well, you know, we'd all love to see the plan.
All right, we'd all love to see the plans. Bill Zimmerman, now you're stoked up and in the mood. I'm sure you've got your medical marijuana all lit up there in California. I got to tell you, actually, last time I drove through Topanga, I had a medical marijuana card, And I went around, I tried to buy some marijuana and, you know, for my aching knees, of course. And, they wouldn't sell it. I went to two places. They wouldn't sell it to me because they said the marijuana card had expired or something like that. So then I was driving up and I picked up a guy, who looked like he was 130 years old. And I told him what had happened. And he said, "Oh man, I got some pot here." And he sold me like for $2 what it would have cost me 15 at the medical marijuana clinic. So, but I don't think that was you.
Well, it could have been hard. You may not know this, but I managed the first medical marijuana campaign here in California and six others that came afterward.
Well, which one won?
The one in California in 1996 was the first one that won and established medical marijuana here in California. And then we went on and did six other successful initiatives in 98 and 2000. They all won.
Where? In different states, you mean?
Yeah, we did in 98 and 2000, we did Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Maine, Colorado, and Nevada.
So you traveled around doing medical marijuana initiatives?
Well, I did then, yes.
So I hope you got some of Sarah Palin. I mean, that would have really been a big help. Clearly it didn't take.
Well, Minnesota doesn't have an initiative, so we were... Oh, I'm sorry. She's from Alaska, right?
Yeah, she's from Alaska, right?
And
so
Alaska, yeah.
Wasn't she... Didn't she say she used to sit on her front porch and toke up and look at Russia?
Through her kitchen window, I believe.
Yeah, yeah, that was it. Okay. Well, now, actually, we have a solemn a message on that. We just lost the great and wonderful Peter Lewis, head of Progressive Insurance, who funded a lot of these initiatives. Isn't that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we worked closely with Peter going back to 1996 and up until the month he died. We're still trying to legalize marijuana, that is, go beyond medical marijuana to full legalization for recreational use. And Peter was very supportive of that effort here in California and in a number of other states.
Well, now that he's gone, and that Peter, for those of you who don't know, Peter Lewis was a billionaire who owned a Progressive insurance and company. And I do think that girl they have, the young woman selling insurance in the Progressive ads, is stoned. I think that's why people like her so much. But what's going to happen now that Peter's gone?
Well, his family is going to decide whether or not to carry on the legacy. And I think in all likelihood they will after, you know, an initial period of bereavement. But there are other funders, including George Soros and John Sperling and a number of other people who have contributed to the medical marijuana.
Bill, you're hanging out.
Pardon me?
Bill, are you?
Harvey?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Were you unable to hear me?
Yeah, you faded in and out. You may have done something with your phone. Are you okay?
I'm sorry. In any case, there are many other funders besides Peter Lewis who have been active in this area, George Soros, John Sperling among them. And Peter's unfortunate death is not going to slow the effort down.
And you must know Peter's nephew, Don Wirtschafter.
Yep.
Okay, so Don is an Ohio boy. I've known him for many years, based in Athens. And he, of course, has a great pioneer in medical marijuana. I will tell you, just to blow my horn a little bit, although this was completely accidental, when I was a senior at the University of Michigan, I was the editorial director. In other words, I had control of the editorial page. And we were a daily, and it was a big paper. And I went in and had a big hole on the left side of the editorial page on Saturday, and it was late, and I had no idea how to fill it. And I just got this inspiration. You know, I had never smoked pot. I was, I guess, 19. I wrote a long civil libertarian piece entitled "The Use of Marijuana, It Should Be Legal." This was in 1966 or 67. I think it was late 66. And I happened to be – this was on a Saturday. And I happened to be the UPI correspondent on campus. And so I wrote the editorial. And before it was in print, I called the UPI and I said, "Hey, you know, some crazy hippie here at the U of M has just written an article for legalizing pot." And they took the story and they put it on the wire. It was a Saturday. And back then, you know, nothing happened on Saturday. And that all these papers had Sunday copy holes to fill. And this article was in every paper in the world. And they called me. I woke up on Sunday morning at 6 a.m. ABC News in New York called me and had me on. And then I did all these TV shows, and I got to go down there and say, well, of course, I've never smoked it myself. I just think it should be legal. And then when that whole thing was done, then I finally smoked pot. That was really a great time. And that, of course, in 66, it was news. Now, today, of course, things have changed. So do you have a full legalization thing coming up in California this fall?
Not this fall, but in 2016. We have been polling for the last couple of weeks trying to decide between whether we should go in 2014 or 2016. And just a day before yesterday made the decision to wait until 2016.
Why?
The electorate is very different in California in a gubernatorial year than in a presidential year. You know, we've had, three out of the last five governors in California have been Republicans, even though this is one of the most Democratic states in the country. And the reason for that is when we elect governors, as we will again in 2014, the turnout is much lower among young people, people of color, and progressive people, who turn out in much larger numbers for presidential elections. So in order to ensure a victory for legalizing recreational marijuana use, we're going to wait till 2016.
Man, if that's two more years, it's going to be busting people.
Well, we don't bust people in California for marijuana. It is currently a $100 fine that is an infraction, not even a misdemeanor. So it's equivalent to a traffic ticket. You pay the fine, and there's no permanent record and no criminal record of any kind. So we don't have people being suffering needlessly for possession arrests here in California.
Yeah, but then the cops take your pot and they smoke it.
Well, that happens, but it happens. Up until the recent election, it's happened more in New York than here in California.
All right. Well, I'll take your word for it. You live in Santa Monica? Oh, no, Topanga. That's right. You're in Topanga, of all places. How long have you been at Topanga Canyon?
No, a long time, 27 years.
Oh, my God. All right. So you've seen a lot. I could talk to you a long time about Santa Monica and about Topanga Canyon, but our listeners want to hear about your book. Tell us about Troublemaker.
Well, it's a memoir of my life in the 60s, and my attempt in writing it was to share with people a little of the strategy behind the things that happened in the 60s. A lot of people tend to look back at that era as a kind of wild and chaotic period in which spontaneous action accounted for most of what was newsworthy. In fact, there was a political movement, several political movements happening during that era. And they were led by people who had a sense of strategy and a set of goals and tactics that were deployed selectively. And I think I thought it would be interesting to give people a look behind the scenes at how some of those events were organized, what leadership thought they were trying to accomplish, and so forth. So the book begins with the civil rights movement in Mississippi. I was there in 1963 working with SNCC. And then
Wait. SNCC is Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. That was the sort of radical wing of the civil rights movement.
And then the book follows my life as I got involved with the anti-war movement. It covers many of the events that I attended and was part of organizing, the March on the Pentagon, the Democratic Convention in Chicago, the May Day demonstrations in the spring of 1971. And then the book follows.
Well, you know what, Bill? I was at all three of those.
Yeah.
So there you go. You must be even as old as I am. Okay, continue, please.
Well, then I also wanted to emphasize the second half of the anti-war movement because it's the first half with all the large public demonstrations gets all the attention. But very interesting things happened after 1971. Which was the last of the big major demonstrations that drew hundreds of thousands of people. So I describe during that period the development of anti-war sentiments within the scientific community. I was part of the group that started Science for the People. I then talk about Medical Aid for Indochina, which is an organization I led from 71 to 73. We raised money here in this country for medical supplies, which were shipped directly to Hanoi as a statement of protest against the war. I then worked with the Indochina Peace Campaign in the lobbying phase of the anti-war movement when we cut off funding to the military in South Vietnam and finally ended the war. And then the last thing covered in the book is the siege at Wounded Knee in South Dakota, where 300 American Indian activists took over the village of Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Reservation and held it by force of arms for 71 days. They were surrounded by an army of FBI agents, U.S. Marshals, and other federal officials in an attempt to starve them out. And I flew an airlift of three airplanes that parachuted 2,000 pounds of food down to them to break the FBI siege.
Are you a pilot? Did you actually fly the planes?
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
And you parachuted stuff out?
We had three single-engine planes, each capable of carrying about 800 pounds of cargo, and we recruited, the necessary number of pilots and parachute handlers, and we flew in there one morning at dawn, April 17th, got there at 5:06 a.m. as the sun was coming over the eastern horizon, and we parachuted, I think we had 10 chutes that came down into the village and fed everybody for the next 3 weeks.
Wow, that's fantastic. Did the
FBI all that's related in the book.
Did anybody shoot at you?
We took a 10 or 12 rounds, but it's very hard to hit an airplane with a rifle. You need a machine gun to do that.
Well, who was shooting at you? Was it the FBI?
No, there was a third force there, tribal policemen.
The goons.
Goons, exactly. And they stood between the FBI lines and the activist lines trying to provoke firefights. And it was reported to us afterward that a number of these people were shooting at our airplanes as we flew by.
But you didn't take any hits?
No, we didn't take any hits.
God, that must have been exciting. Do you still fly?
Yeah, I do occasionally.
Well, fantastic. Good for you. That's amazing. Well, then I can't let that go by without mentioning Leonard Peltier. You must have known Leonard or met him along the way somewhere.
Yeah, the incident that he was incarcerated for happened 2 years after the siege. The FBI, after the end of the occupation of Wounded Knee, sort of occupied the Pine Ridge Reservation. There was a great deal of harassment by the FBI. There were some 20 people who were assassinated in the 9 months after the end of the occupation. So the place degenerated into an armed camp with AIM, American Indian Movement activists on one side and the FBI on the other. And 2 years after the occupation of Wounded Knee, there was a firefight between activists and Indians. And an FBI agent was killed, and Peltier was framed for the murder.
It's unbelievable that he's gone through 8 years of Bill Clinton, and now X number of years, five, 6 years of Barack Obama, and nobody's moved to help this guy at all. It's
well,
terrible.
Actually, people have tried. As you can imagine, a lot of people tried to influence Clinton and are now trying to influence Obama, but there's an organized group of former FBI agents and the families of FBI agents.
Bill, you're fading out again.
Pardon me?
You're fading out again.
Oh, I'm sorry. There's an organized group of FBI agents and families of FBI agents who oppose Peltier's release. And whenever a president considers commutation or pardon, these current and former agents speak up and create public controversy in an attempt to prevent any sympathy for Peltier.
Well, they've been successful so far, but why not just give them a new trial?
Well, there are all kinds of ways to help them, but so far we haven't succeeded in doing any of them.
Well, it's terrible. It's astounding to me that he's been in there, I think, 9 years longer than Nelson Mandela was at Robben Island.
Yeah, good comparison.
It's terrible. Bill, what else about your book? And then we're going to move and talk about student loans, which is, to me, a huge issue now. But can we still get your book and Troublemaker? And,
yeah.
And
the book is still available. The paperback is still in print. It's an Anchor paperback, and it's not in every store for sure, but you can certainly get it from any of the online stores, and any independent bookstore can easily order it.
Well, it must have been a lot of fun for you to write it.
It was a lot of fun writing it. It gave me a chance to go back and look at old files and newspaper clippings and letters and photographs and put it all together in a coherent way, but it was fun to relive some of those experiences.
Well, you worked with Fred Branfman and Tom Hayden on the Indochina peace campaign, is that right?
Yes.
And they're still around. I think Fred is in Europe, but Tom Hayden, I think, is still in Southern California, is that correct?
Yeah, Tom and I see each other all the time. Fred's living in Budapest.
Excellent, excellent. So, any issues with us? I hope I am going to be in L.A., actually, for the Fukushima demonstrations on the 11th. I hope you'll join us. I believe there's one going to be at the consulate downtown, and then there will be one somewhere else in the L.A. area on March 11th. I will be fasting for Fukushima. Maybe you can spread the word as well. This is however bad you think Fukushima is, it's about 100 times worse, and we don't even know for sure what's going on there. That's probably the worst part of all at this point in time.
Well, I'd be glad to help you out when you're in L.A.
All right. Well, we'll be in touch on that. So what got me to you in the first place was an article you wrote about student loans. Now, I happen to have five children. We've gotten three of them through college and even graduate school without student loans. I've got a fourth one about to graduate, but I've also got a 14-year-old in ninth grade. So student loans are a specter on the horizon. I teach at two colleges here in Central Ohio, and my kids, my students, it is so sad, they just have this weight on their shoulders. So tell us, your article on student loans was one of the first I've seen in a long, long time. I think it's a huge issue. Tell us about it. Tell us what you think and why you're writing about it.
Well, there are two reasons to write about it. One is there are an enormous number of people suffering under this debt burden, and the other is that over $1 trillion in unsecured debt, which is the student loan total, presents an enormous danger to the overall American economy, not unlike the danger of housing debt that we saw ruin the economy in 2008. We have roughly 40 million Americans, 40 million, who owe money on student loans. Of that number, 6 million have already gone into default. Another 12 to 13 million are chronically behind in their payments because they don't have good employment. None of these people in trouble can discharge their student loans through bankruptcy, because in 1998, the Congress took bankruptcy away from federal student loans. And in 2005, even more outrageously, Congress passed a law that said you can't discharge a private student loan, private between the student and the bank.
How can they do that? How can they add, it seems to me when you took a loan from a private lender that there was a contract in place. And so what they've done is after the fact they've changed the law?
That's correct.
Has this been tested in the courts?
Yes.
And we've lost.
And we lost. This debt is not dischargeable. So where that leaves the borrower is like living in a debtor's prison without walls, because that borrower cannot get the credit or the decent jobs that are needed to pay off the loan. If you're behind in your student loan and your credit rating is in the toilet, you can't rent an apartment, you can't borrow money to go to graduate school, you can't borrow money to start a new business, you can't buy a new car. So you're not participating in the economy, which hurts the rest of us, but you also are curtailed in terms of your ability to make money in order to pay off the loan. So it's like a permanent thing that you can never get out of. Now, there are some truly outrageous aspects of this. A lot of students are unable to get loans without getting cosigners. If a parent cosigns a loan and the student is then unable to pay off the loan because he or she can't find a job after graduation, the parent becomes fully liable for the full amount of the loan. Some parents unable to pay off such loans have lost their homes. Many parents are now unable to cosign student loans for their children because they haven't finished paying off their own student loans. In those situations, children have often gone to grandparents and said, hey, I need someone to sign my student loan. And the grandparent, not fully aware of how much financial liability comes with that decision, says, yes, I'll co-sign your loan, sure. The student then defaults, and the grandparent becomes liable. In 2012, there were 119,000 Social Security recipients having their benefits garnished to pay off student loans.
Oh, my God.
There are people on disability payments whose disability checks are garnished for that purpose. It's outrageous, and there isn't a single entity in government that's doing anything about this. So I got into it, decided to write a book and develop.
Well, wait. Before you do this, why did you get into it? What got you into it?
Well, I think there is an amazing opportunity here for progressives to organize people in their own self-interest. There's an audience of 40 million people that need, or most of whom need help. The help they need is to get relief from the banks. If we can organize those people in a campaign in which they're working for their own self-interest, targeting the banks, and they come as they do from all across the political spectrum, this could become a model for citizen action that can be applied to other areas. We need to go after the wealth and privilege of the banking industry in our society for all kinds of reasons, not just to get relief on student loans. If we can use student loans as a way to organize people that targets the banks and has the objective of advancing their own self-interest, I think we can create a model for organizing that can have much wider application than student loans. And on the way, hopefully provide some relief to those people who are trapped in this student loan maze.
Now, do any of your kids have student loans?
No. My son was able to get through college and law school on his own and with my help. My daughter needed loans to get through law school, and she is still paying off those loans. But because she's a public interest lawyer working for the ACLU, she's in a program where her law school, which was Yale, will help pay down her loan as long as she continues in the public interest field and doesn't make more money than a certain threshold figure that they've established.
I love that. You got student loans. You're trying to pay back your student loans, but if you make too much money, you get screwed.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there's a solution to all of this, which I advocate in the book, two reforms that would solve the problem. One would be to make all interest rates on student loans nonprofit, whether the loan is coming from the federal government or a bank. The interest rate on the loan should be the Federal Reserve's discount rate. That's the rate that banks have to pay when they borrow money from the Federal Reserve. Currently, that rate is 0.75%. So that's the rate that should be applied to students because we shouldn't be making, nobody should be making money off lending students money to go to college. The second reform that's needed is to make the repayment of the loan income-based rather than fixed. Right now, the loans require a fixed monthly payment, regardless of how much money the student has or is making. If you made the payments income-based, you would take, say, 10% of the student's income after essentials are paid for, like housing, food, medical care, and so forth. Take those out, measure what's left, take 10% of that, and make that the amount due on the student loan. That's called income-based repayment. Now, reforms like that, like these two, would cost the banking industry many, many billions of dollars. So the question is that a fair solution to the banks? And the answer is, according to calculations I made in the book that you mentioned earlier, the banks have made roughly $800 billion off the student loan industry that they helped create. And that's over the last 30 years in which student loans have been a big factor in higher education. So having made $800 billion already, it seems fair to require of them the return of some portion of that money to help solve the current student loan crisis. God knows they're positioned to make plenty of money going forward, so this is a hit the banks could take without suffering too much damage.
Wow. We're talking with Bill Zimmerman, author of Troublemaker, about his exploits in the 1960s and up through Wounded Knee in 1973. And now, what's the name of your book on student loans?
The student loan book is called The Student Loan Swindle. How it happened, who's to blame, how to save the victims. It's an e-book. It's not a printed book. It's an e-book available on Kindle or Nook or iBooks, and I'm selling it for 99 cents so that nobody can be deprived of this book for lack of funds. I'm not trying to make any money off the book. I just want to put it out there and have it be used as an organizing tool, because the book lays out a plan by which a civil disobedience campaign can be mounted to win these two reforms from a reluctant government and a banking industry that would be adamantly opposed.
Well, let's hear it quickly. We've got 12 minutes left, so tell us as much as you can about this civil disobedience campaign.
Well, you know, one of the ways that labor organizers encourage people to strike in situations where they're trying to organize strikes is they go in and they say to each individual, "Will you strike if he strikes?" So that nobody has to take an action all by themselves, but action becomes collective. I think that approach can be applied in this situation through the Internet. And I'm advocating the establishment of a website in which people can pledge to stop making payments on their loans unless these two reforms that I just mentioned are instituted by the government. And that pledge is made on condition that 5 million other people make the same pledge. It's likely to take a year or two to build to such large numbers, but imagine what happens over that period of time as the number of people who have promised to stop paying their loans increases into the millions. Those people have political power at that point, and that power can be focused on the Congress, which is the one institution of government most vulnerable to public opinion. It can be the center of a major controversy that would involve political groups across the spectrum who have nothing to do with student loans, but who want to weigh in on a massive civil disobedience campaign of this size. And I think if the numbers build in the way I think they might, nobody would actually have to stop making payments, because the banks and the Congress would be so afraid of 5 million people simultaneously engaging in an act of civil disobedience that they couldn't control. And I think they would cave under the pressure and create the reforms needed to solve the student loan problem. So that's what I'm advocating in this e-book. And how to do it is laid out in some detail, And I'm hoping that enough people get interested in this to create the critical mass necessary to make this happen.
How do people get the ebook?
It can be purchased from any of the usual sites, Amazon for Kindle, Barnes & Noble for Nook, Apple, iTunes Store for an iBook. People don't necessarily have to have those machines. You can go to Amazon, for example, and download the Kindle software to your regular computer and then buy Kindle books for your computer. And you can do the same thing for the other ebook formats.
And how long has this one been available?
This is brand new. It was just published last week.
Did you do it yourself? Do you have a publisher do it?
No, I did it myself. It's a relatively easy technology to master, and it creates a whole new opportunity for people to write books and make them available immediately without going through a publisher, which often takes much longer. You can price the book anywhere you want. Those are the advantages. The disadvantages are that you don't have the publisher publicizing your book. There's no advertising budget unless you put it up yourself. So it's harder to get the word out. But you can certainly circulate something much faster than you can in the traditional way.
Very interesting. How long is the book?
The book is not that long. It's roughly 30,000 words. Probably be about 50 pages of an ordinary book. And I try to include a complete picture of the student loan problem, the history, how it got started in 1965, what the implications are, as well as the strategy and tactics that I'm advocating. This whole thing got off the ground in 1965 with the passage of the Higher Education Act, which was part of President Johnson's war on poverty. And it was misguided from the beginning because instead of the government lending students money out of the treasury, the government allowed the banks to put up the cash for the federal student loans in exchange for a guarantee from the federal government that the loans would be repaid. So the banks got the interest on the loans and, in effect, got a risk-free business established for them by government. Because if they put up the money and the students were unable to repay the loans they received, the government would repay the banks. So the banks had nothing at risk. And this was a relatively small operation when it first started in 65 and through the 70s, because college was still affordable then. And many people could go to college without student loans.
Right. My tuition at the University of Michigan in 1963 was $450 a semester. And it went down from there. So,
yeah, well, I started college in 1958 at one of the most expensive private universities in the country, the University of Chicago. And my tuition was $870 a year.
Yeah.
I mean, it was totally different then.
That won't even cover your books anymore.
Right. All of this changed in the 80s when the conservatives took over the American economy. The conservative thrust in the 80s and 90s reduced state budgets by cutting back on taxation. And the reduction in those state budgets led to legislators lowering the appropriations for their state universities, state colleges, and community colleges. And as those appropriations went down in the 80s and 90s, the administrators of the colleges had no choice but to increase tuition. So we saw massive increases in tuition that began in the 80s and are still going on today. We all know that the cost of health care in this country inflated dramatically during the same period, much faster than the overall rate of inflation. But few people know that the rate of inflation for higher education was twice the rate of health care. In other words, the cost of getting a college education went up twice as fast as the cost of health care.
Well, that's shocking, given how fast the healthcare has gone up.
Yeah,
end in sight, is there?
It was roughly in the last 30 years, the cost of living has roughly doubled. The cost of higher education has gone up by a factor of 12.
Oh, God.
So once that happened, the student loan business that government had created for the banks suddenly became enormously lucrative, because now not just a few students needed loans, but almost all students needed loans. And the loans they were getting were not for a few hundred dollars or a few thousand dollars a year to pay for tuition, as it was when you and I went to school. But now the loans were for tens of thousands of dollars per year, every year, to get through college. So the interest income being or the interest profit being generated by those loans became astronomical.
That's
and
ridiculous.
The banks had suddenly gotten a business that was not just good for a few billion dollars a year, but suddenly was good for tens of billions of dollars a year.
Right. We're talking with Bill Zimmerman. We're just about out of time, Bill. Author of Troublemaker. What's your publisher with Troublemaker?
Anchor Paperback.
And the title of your book on student loans?
The Student Loan Swindle.
And that, the Student Loan Swindle is available online, Kindle, Nook. What are the other ones?
iTunes.
iTunes,
and,
all
and,
that stuff.
Any other ebook format.
And it's Bill Zimmerman. Bill, thank you so much for being with us. I will drive through and wave at you at Topanga on my way to Will Rogers. But I hope to see you on Fukushima Day. Earlier we talked about the demonstrations around the world on March 11th. This has been another great Solartopia Green Power and Wellness show. Thanks so much, Bill, for being with us. And thank you for listening in, folks, at home. We will be demonstrating on March 11th. We'll get posted on that. And I will be defaulting on my student loans as soon as I possibly can. We'll see you next week at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness show. As the world gets better and better, we are moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we